Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Communications Minister Malcolm Turnbull had a substantial win this week, and it wasn't in his own portfolio. The government has been forced to concede the point that Turnbull and some other ministers made, that its original plan to remove citizenship from dual nationals involved in terrorism was flawed. The idea was to vest the power of decision-making in the immigration minister, but it turned out that that would have been unconstitutional, and now the government has gone down another route. Malcolm Turnbull joins us today to talk about matters in his own portfolio and more widely. Malcolm Turnbull, let's start with the big issue of the week in your bailiwick, and that is the controversy over Q&A. The program had a former terrorism suspect who was convicted of threatening to kill Commonwealth officers there in its audience and asking a question. You've been very critical of Q&A, but some ask, what about free speech? After all, the Coalition wanted to change the Racial Discrimination Act to allow people to say more outrageous things than they can at the moment.
As I said in the House, Michelle, Zaki Mallah was a very known quantity. He had been charged with terrorism-related offences. He was acquitted of them, as it happens, but there's no question he had purchased a gun and 100 rounds of ammunition. He was convicted of firearm offences separately. He pleaded guilty to charges of threatening to kill Commonwealth officers, and he served a term of imprisonment. He's been to Syria some capacity with the Syrian Free Army, he's asserted. His social media presence is vile, abusive, and violent, especially violent. I simply say that I think it was an error of judgment to allow him to be in the audience of a live program, both from the point of view of the type of things he might say, and of course from a physical security point of view. There apparently was, so I understand, there was no, well, so I've been advised, I should say, there was no particular security checks taken with respect to that audience. So on that, look, I think it was a grave error of judgment, and I don't back away from that.
Are you satisfied with the answers that top ABC people have given you? You've spoken to a number of them. Do you think that they understand your point of view, that they accept it?
I think they accept that it was an error of judgment. They've said so. No one likes being criticised, and the ABC is no different. But they recognise there was an error of judgment. There is going to be a review of Q&A. Now, this was initiated prior to this program, I might say, and it was initiated by the board, which, as you know, has a statutory obligation to ensure that news and current affairs are accurate and impartial. And they have done reviews on election coverage, on budget coverage, on asylum seeker coverage. Now they're doing a review on Q&A, and it will look at choice of topics, choice of guests, composition of audience, balance, and they should be doing that. I mean, they do have the ABC has a very heavy obligation to be balanced, to be accurate and impartial. And I think in many respects that obligation is more important than ever, because as so many other of the big foundations of journalism in Australia are under stress, because of the declining economics of the newspaper industry in particular, the ABC's presence is more important than ever. So they really do have to... And this is the board's responsibility, by the way. I mean, I get lots of emails from people saying, 7:30 was right or wrong, or, you know, and sometimes people are saying it was biased to the left, biased to the right. I'm not the editorial director of the ABC. It's completely independent from government, and so it should be. It's the board that has this responsibility to ensure that it complies with the Act, and they've got to take it very seriously, and this review is part of that.
There's going to be a managing director job going in the ABC fairly soon.
Have you got your resume in?
Well, I'm just wondering, if you weren't in Parliament, would you be wanting to go for that job? It's a pretty hot seat.
It is. It's a very big job, I must say, and I think it's obviously it's going to be very important to make a very good choice. It's the board's choice, I might say. I mean, the government, as you know, appoints directors as and when vacancies occur. The choice of the managing director is the board, and they have started a search now because Mark Scott's term runs out early next year.
Now, Tony Abbott told the party room this week that the government would bring back something, I think was his words, when MPs return from the winter break in relation to the Q&A affair. What sort of something could that be? Would the government consider, for example, boycotting the program?
Well, I've never... a number of people... I mean, Corey Bernardi made that suggestion. I've never had that suggestion made to me by any of my... any other colleagues. Well, not that I can recall. Certainly no other ministerial colleagues. You've got to remember this about... the ABC and this, and you know, this apply. There are plenty of media platforms where people feel the host or the presenter is, or the context is unfavourable to them politically. But the reality is that Q&A has a very large audience. It's a very popular program. We are in the business of communicating our policies, promoting our policies, and from time to time pointing out the deficiencies in our opponents. So we need to be on as many platforms as we can, and that goes from your podcast to, you know, the highest rating program on commercial television. So I think the point I always make to colleagues who become frustrated by what they think is the bias of interviewers or the bias of a studio audience, I always say to them, just remember, when that microphone is live and you are speaking, nobody can put words into your mouth. You know, when you are speaking that microphone, that is you, undiluted, and everyone that's listening or watching and listening is getting your message.
Over the years, I must say, I've seen many governments very critical of the ABC, but I don't think I recall a government being as critical for as long as this one has been. There seems to be a particularly strong feeling in the coalition this time around about the public broadcaster.
Well, it was only last week that Tony Abbott was praising the ABC for Sarah Ferguson's series on the Labor government, The Killing Season.
I think he was also being a bit ironic.
Well, he was certainly praising it. I think he said, thank God for the ABC. So... I know that when he was very, Tony was very generous in his praise of Emma Alberici when she had a celebrated row with a gentleman from Hizbut Tahir on some of these issues. So, firstly, I cannot challenge what you're saying because you've got a memory and a time in this place that surpasses mine by a very considerable margin. So I can't argue with the point you're making about this government relative to others. I'd say this, though, that news media is always going to be controversial. The problem the ABC has, or the reality the ABC is this, I think that generally... the media has become more opinionated. I think that's partly a function of the fact that you've now got so many different platforms. You can, in effect, choose a news channel or a news source that conforms with your political slant or political preferences. So I think the media generally has become more opinionated. Now, the problem for the ABC is that they can't do that. You know, that may be the spirit of the times, good, bad or indifferent, but it's not open to the ABC to do that. So, you know, someone can say, I think the Daily Telegraph is, you know, too right-wing, or I think the Guardian is too left-wing, or I think the Conversation is too whatever-wing, depending on your point of view. But and you can express those views, but all of those platforms are entitled to be as biased as they like. If they can say, so what? We can take whatever editorial line we like. The ABC doesn't have that luxury. You know, their bargain with the taxpayer is in return for well over $1 billion every year, they've got to provide accurate and impartial news and current affairs in accordance with the accepted standards of objective journalism.
Now, can I turn to another area in your portfolio, and that's media law reform. You flagged a while ago that you wanted to change the rule that stops an organisation owning a TV station, a radio licence and a newspaper in one market. Mm-hmm. And you also wanted to scrap the rule that limits the expansion of a TV network's ownership to cover more than 75% of the population. Now these changes are apparently off. What's happened? What is the state of play?
Well, the government's always said that we wanted to see a degree of industry consensus in support of change. And I regret to say that consensus has not emerged. And what the Prime Minister said just a week or so ago was that he, in the absence of such consensus, those reforms were off the table. But they do have that has real consequences. And the industry players who cannot agree have got to reflect on this. You know, the regional broadcasters, for example, who would dearly like the reach rule to be removed so that they were able to merge with a national broadcaster.
This is the 75%
reach rule, yeah. Are really doing it very hard. Not only are they suffering the decline in advertising revenue that affects most of the traditional media, but increasingly and of course competition from over the top platforms like Netflix and so forth. But the national networks, of course, are increasingly broadcasting, often over the internet, into their area. So they were generally over the internet. So, you know, Channel 7 streams a lot of sport nationally over the net. Obviously, regional affiliate of Channel 7 doesn't get any benefit from that. If you miss MasterChef, or My Kitchen Rules, or some whatever your favourite program is, and you in a regional area, and you decide to watch it on catch-up TV, you'll be watching it on a catch-up site run by the national network, the Metropolitan Network, with their ads in it. So, you know, they are getting squeezed, and of course this is one of the reasons why we're seeing the closure and scaling down of local news and community service activities by the regional stations. So there are real consequences to this.
Can I just take up your point that the government is not going ahead because it can't get industry agreement? This is surely a very special circumstance. Mostly, if you needed to do something about an industry, you would do it. If you could get it through Parliament, you wouldn't say, well, all the players must agree.
No, I hear that, Michelle. I think that's a fair criticism, but the industry, media industry is so competitive and, of course, has a very loud voice. It's obviously preferable if there is a higher degree of consensus than there is. And that's been the pattern in the past. Media law reform in the past has generally proceeded on the basis of
a sweetheart deal.
Of consensus. I mean, where the industry feels that, you know, all the different participants with competing interests are being treated fairly.
But it does reflect a government's awareness of the power of the media moguls.
I think that's fear of them. That's a comment that's certainly very open to you to make. But I just all I can do is repeat what the Prime Minister has said.
Now, the government has put changes through the parliament to restrict access to illegal downloading of websites. Britain did this a few years ago and it only had limited success. Why do you think it'll be more successful here?
Well, that's not what the British say. The British believe that their site blocking legislation actually did have some considerable success. There is no one silver bullet, let me be quite clear. What the legislation does is it only deals with foreign sites, because obviously if somebody is Australian website is sharing, you know, copyright infringing material, then it's open for the rights owners to sue them in the Australian courts. So we're talking about offshore sites and jurisdictions where there's no practical recourse to legal action. And what this enables a rights owner to do, if this, and these are typically sites, Pirate Bay is the classic example. And this enables the rights owner to go to the court and say, we want an order that to the ISPs that they should block access to this site, and they will do that, if assuming they satisfied that it is, you know, primarily for the purpose of facilitating the infringement of copyright. And the legislation's been drafted in a way to ensure that it's really aimed at the worst offenders, and of the kind I've described. And so what you would expect is a person tries to go to that site, they end up on a landing page which says, look, you can't go to Pirate Bay because of a court order. Here are all these places where you can buy, you know, movies, TV, music, whatever, legally.
Now, one issue in downloading is that access to much sought-after material is more limited in Australia than, for example, the United States. Given that this is the age of the internet, should the government be trying to address this in some manner?
Well, we can't force people to license content in Australia, but the reality is that they are making much more content is being made available in a timely fashion. You know, it used to be the case where you could have a TV show in the States and then release it on Australian television 6 months later, but nowadays you can't. In practical terms, you've got to make it available effectively at the same time, may not be precisely at the same hour of, you know, minute because of time zone differences. But it's really got to be available in a very, very timely fashion. And I think everybody understands that. I mean, territorial copyright is really being shaken up and, if not completely threatened, by the advent of the internet. And that's it's a global business. So you're right, and they need to make that material available, and we've said that publicly, and it is clearly part of the solution. That's the self-help part of the solution for them.
Now, turning to the citizenship law, your view has prevailed on this, and the legislation now doesn't have the ministerial discretion that was being originally proposed. Are you now confident that it's safe from constitutional challenge or successful challenge?
Yeah, I'm glad you qualified it. Nothing safe from constitutional challenge. I think I don't really want to be giving constitutional opinions on legislation that the government's introduced, so I'd really leave that to the attorney. But I just, you know, what the attorney has said, Attorney General has said, is that essentially that the government is confident it would survive constitutional challenge. But it's certainly the fact that there isn't a ministerial discretion to, you know, form a view about somebody's essentially criminal conduct and then take their citizenship away. The fact that that's no longer there obviously mitigates this Chapter 3 separation of powers point that, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about.
You fought this pretty hard. Did you get any thank yous from anyone?
You had to fight your way through the bouquets in the lobby here. You can see it's
just
chocolates, you know, everywhere. Yeah, of course.
There was a lot of kerfuffle over the leak of the original cabinet fracas over this. But when you look back on it, that leak one could say was actually helpful to the government, because it flushed out early some issues and saved it from itself.
Well,
do you agree with that?
In the words of Frank Underwood, you may very well say that, but I couldn't possibly comment.
Well, perhaps you can comment on this. Some would say that the government is over-egging the whole terrorism, national security issue. That, yes, there's an issue here, things need to be done, but we're now in an era of massive hype about this. Is there something in this criticism?
Well, I wouldn't concede that, but I would say that criticism is not fair. But I don't. In other words, I don't agree with it. But people. This is a democracy. People are entitled to discuss terrorism and national security and the right measures. They're big issues, Michelle, and we expect them to be a lively debate about it. And I see there's been, quite a lot of discussion on the Conversation website about it.
One issue that's been of interest to you over a number of years and to your electors in the seat of Wentworth is gay marriage. Mm-hmm. You support a conscience vote for Liberals, you support a change in the law. Do you think there will be a vote on legislation in the Parliament this year?
Yes, I think there will be. I think the Liberal Party room will agree to a free vote. That's my judgment. I think and if that's the case, there certainly will be a bill.
Doesn't the bill have to come before the Liberal Party will face up to the vote in the party room?
This issue will be dealt with when we get back from the winter break.
And you think people are doing work on it, cross-party work at the moment?
Oh, yes, there is. No, there's even, you should... there are a number of men, private, backbenchers who are working very hard with this, and I know talking to people on the other side of the chamber about it. My gut feeling is, without having done any counting, that I think there will be a free vote. Will it pass the House and the Senate? Too early to say, but this is an issue. I've never seen a social issue upon which opinions have changed as rapidly as this. Look, I'll give you a bit of history. The famous expression that marriage is a permanent union between a man and a woman to the exclusion of all others comes from a British court case in the 1850s called Hyde and Hyde, which related to the validity of a marriage contracted in Utah at a time when Utah had polygamy. And the court, through the Chancellor, Baron Penzance, this wasn't a moralistic observation, but he did a review of what marriage meant around the world. And he said in all of Christendom, which we could say today means the Western world, for argument's sake, this is what a marriage is defined at. And there's no doubt he was correct about that. If you look at the Western, we won't use the term Christendom, we could if you like, but let's say the Western world, or the countries that are culturally closest to us, you couldn't make that statement. I mean, gay marriage is legal in the UK, it's legal in two-thirds or 70% possibly now of the United States. It's legal in Canada, it's legal in New Zealand, it's legal in South Africa, it's legal in France, it's legal, in Spain and so forth. So it's a very long list. So it is difficult to, and of course it's been approved in Ireland just recently in a referendum, so it's difficult to, there are fewer and fewer countries or jurisdictions that are comparable to Australia where gay marriage is not legal nowadays. So, that is a very big factor. And attitudes to marriage and what a marriage is have always been guided by international practice, I might add, because, of course, a big part of private international law relates to the recognition of marriages contracted in one jurisdiction or another, because it affects all sorts of things, not just marriages but property and children's rights and so forth. And so you can see that there has been this massive change in a relatively short time.
Now, just finally, Bill Shorten this week told his caucus that there was a possibility of an election being called before Parliament resumes for the spring session. Mm. Do you think that there will be an election this year?
Well, I've got no reason to believe there will be. My expectation is there'll be an election, in August or September or thereabouts next year, when it's expected, when the Parliament's term runs out.
You don't think there'll be another surprise from a no surprises government?
Again, these are comments for you. And you, Michelle, who have seen more snap elections and surprise elections and even unsurprising elections than any of us, are the best able to judge that.
Malcolm Turnbull, thank you very much for talking with us once again. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.